This week on Desert Digest, the dining podcast of Phoenix Magazine, we've got Valley Coffee pioneer Julia Pesciotto in studio to talk about her eponymous East Valley coffee shop. We also have news and notes from around the valley here on Desert Digest. This week on Desert Digest, the dining podcast of Phoenix Magazine, we've got a very special guest in studio, coffee pioneer, Valley Coffee pioneer, and maybe our most famous Brasileira, Julia Pesciotto from Pesciotto Coffee. Hey, Julia.
Hi, Craig.
Thanks for joining us. We also have Leah Lemoine, managing editor of the magazine. Hey, Leah.
Hey, Craig. Hey, Julia.
Hi, Leah.
I'm Craig. I'm the editor. So I understand you usually go back to Brazil for the summer, at least part of it. Did we catch you before your trip?
You did. I'm about to leave on Monday. So in a few days, I'll be migrating south of the equator.
Yeah.
And my plan is to be there for a month. Normally, we go during the summer months because it's the harvest season for our coffee, and we've been able to go every year since we started Pesciotto Coffee, except for 2020 for obvious reasons.
Right.
No one could fly anywhere. So I'm looking forward to it.
And you own Pesciotto Coffee. We should, stipulate that, I guess, for listeners who might not be familiar. Based in Gilbert initially, right?
In Chandler.
Chandler. Okay. But you're expanding into Gilbert.
That's right. Yes. We're opening our second location in Gilbert.
Awesome. And you also, we'll talk about that a little later. We'll also talk about your whole philosophy. Farm to cup, I think, was something that a term we heard bandied around a little bit. And that's fun and fun to talk about. Before we get into all that, we have our weekly news and notes section. We call it Tip of the Tongue. And this week, I guess some of the bigger news items, one of them is a vegan food festival that will be happening in September. It's Vegan Restaurant Week. It's the vegan version of Phoenix or Arizona Restaurant Week. So a bunch of restaurants get together. They offer, a pre-feast menu of people can go in, try a bunch of different things. Sounds like a lot of fun if you're a vegan. If you love cauliflower pizza, there probably will be a few items there for you. Offerings. 25 restaurants confirmed so far, and including such plant-based luminaries as Pachi Mama, Early Bird Vegan, and the Giving Tree Cafe. So there you go.
That's exciting.
It is exciting. Well, it's for any food festival or food event is exciting right now. I think everybody's ready to consume as much as possible. Also this week, we found out that Huss Brewing, one of the Valley's big microbrewery successes, craft brewing successes, is also expanding like you. They're going to open a tap room and full service restaurant at the convention center downtown, which is cool. That part of downtown feels a little sleepy sometimes. But it's it's neat. They have this event space down there, and there are some really cool historical parts of Phoenix in that area as well, like the Teeter House and the places like that. So good to see something like the convention center engaging with a local business to make that that part of downtown come alive a little bit. You read about that, Leah. You wrote about it this week.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it'll be a good representation for out-of-town visitors, to get a taste of the Arizona brewing scene there, as well as for locals to take advantage of. So it's exciting.
They used to have a beer festival. They hopefully will have it there again. Wild and Woody Beer Festival inside one. It was in July. So, of course, you have to have it indoors unless you want, heat stroke.
Die.
Yeah, right. Left and right. Yeah, I think, especially during the summer, it's an underutilized resource, the convention center. So good to see it getting used a little bit. Also this week, Christopher's at Wrigley Mansion has been open for a month or so, 2 months. Nikki Buchanan, our food critic, is reviewing it in our next issue. So keep an eye out for that. But the thing that's interesting about that restaurant, and Christopher Gross, the, you know, James Beard award-winning chef, is the main man there. His nightly concept is a, you know, 8-course, $250 pre-feast menu, but he's kind of scaling it back a little bit for lunch. They're going to start lunch service here pretty soon. It's also it's a 3-course menu this time. And $65 a person, mussels, roasted chicken, tartan. How would you say, Leah?
Tartatan. Yeah, I think.
There you go.
But I like that. Yes, it's like that menu is like his greatest hits, kind of.
Yeah.
Other things, which is nice for people who have followed his career over the years. And they're like, oh, I want that roasted red pepper soup that he was so famous for. You can't get it on the fancy, over the top menu at dinner, but you can enjoy it for lunch. So that's cool.
Yeah, totally cool.
Yeah.
And then we also talk about openings and closings every week, and not a lot of activity, which is good in terms of the closings. This week, nothing we haven't already discussed. You know, we talked about Bandera and Old Town Scottsdale closing. I did read a Hooters in Gilbert was closing. So, what a tragedy, right? And and then opening the Chic Chef. What is her name? Do you know?
I don't know. Maddie, our associate editor, has been working on trying to get in touch with her. I don't know her name. I just know Chef to the Stars.
Chef to the Stars is what you read, right? Yeah. And a lot of press releases were flying around. I did see it in my inbox a few times. Yeah. She has a food store market concept that's opening up in Midtown Phoenix, and that's open this week. And then I guess a restaurant later down the line. So that opened this week. Go ahead.
I also just heard about just hours ago, I got a press release about a new place called Eat Up Drive-In in Arcadia. So it's sort of like a drive-in style, and it's by the same people who own Diego Pops and the Montauk. Huh. So that should be interesting. I hope to try those out soon and maybe do a first dish for our blog.
Yeah. It's a drive-in.
Yeah.
Cool. But
upscale food. So nice salads and hot chicken sandwiches and ribs and that kind of stuff. So that'll be fun. Yeah.
Is it by Upward? Please.
I don't know. I think they're called, I don't know the restaurant. It's J-O-C-Q-U-E. Now I don't know how to say it. Joke. I don't know.
I'm always good tartan, so I don't know.
Word too. Gotta know the language first before I chime in.
Absolutely. Locally owned drive-ins are not all that common, so cool. Yeah. I think the only one I can think of offhand is The Stand.
Yes.
The drive-thru window at Federal Pizza. Love that thing.
Mm-hmm.
Julia, thanks for coming by. So, how long have you had Peixoto Coffee in Chandler?
We started Peixoto in January of 2015, so 6.5 years.
Right.
Can't believe. I still remember when Leah came through her doors.
That's right. She was one of your earliest supporters.
She was. She's been a supporter all along and still one of my favorite pieces ever written about us.
Right. And that when I read it, the cool hook for me was the fact that you own the coffee farm down in Brazil where you source your beans from. So that's where the farm to cup, phrase comes from. So when did you move to the States, and how long did it take you after you moved here to, start selling coffee?
Yeah. So it was quite the journey. I was born and raised in Brazil. So I was born on the countryside of Brazil.
What part of Brazil was that?
It's southeast of Brazil. It's I was born in a small town called Batatais. No one has ever heard of it, so don't worry.
Is that Gisele Bündchen country?
No.
South Brazil.
No, her genes are farther south, so she's more of a German descent. Right. That's why she has all the height, and haven't been blessed with that. But yeah, so I grew up in the countryside of Brazil and I grew up in a coffee farming family. I'm just telling you this for context, because if I just tell you when I got here, it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense for your listeners. So grew up watching my family farm coffee. My father has farmed coffee his whole life. He was born at a coffee farm, my grandfather. And when it was time to sell those coffees, my family was always at the mercy of the ups and downs of the commodities market, right, having nothing to do with what they produced, you know, the pricing. It had everything to do with speculation or too much supply, not enough demand. So I never thought that it was a fair way, you know, for the farmers to trade this very product that they gave their lives to. Didn't know why it was done that way. So I had my childhood in Brazil. I went to law school in Brazil. And then after I finished my law school degree, I came to the U.S. I came straight from Brazil to Tucson, Arizona. So I did a master's program at the U of A. And then I got a job at a very large company where I worked for about 13 years. I met my husband, I had kids, and was not really...
Were you practicing law? Were you in-house counsel for this company?
I was. Oh. Yes, I was in-house counsel for Deutsche Post, DHL. So that's the position that I worked for over a decade. I was not really thinking about coffee because, you know, in my family, I was always encouraged to go pursue a professional career. That was important for my parents. They wanted us to have stable living. So, but when my grandfather passed away in 2012, it got me thinking that my father was the last one of his family who was still farming coffee, who was still, you know, producing this amazing product and trading in the commodities market. So it got me thinking.
Spinning his wheels to some extent, though, in this commodities market, the way you describe it, you know, the farmer, the producer doesn't have much effect. It's you're a little bit, you know, at the mercy of the market.
Yeah, it's rarely, you know, the farmers calling out their price. It's usually, I have this coffee. How much are you willing to pay for it? Which is, you know, not only the based on the commodities price, but what they get is usually 20 to 30% below whatever the commodities market is doing. So that's the market that my father was trading in and all the farmers in the region where I come from. So it hit me when my grandfather passed away that I had to do something with my family's coffee. I felt this awakening, this, you know, this calling that I couldn't dismiss, that I had to do something, had no idea what it would be. So started to play with the idea that we would import my family's coffee and then just sell to local roasters as an agricultural product and
right. Bypass, you know, the market.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So the more we looked into it, we decided, well, if we really want to make justice to the farmer and carry the family's legacy forward, then we need to sell it as special to coffee. And that's when my husband and I decided, you know what? We're going to do everything. We're going to be the roasters. We're going to be the importers. We're going to be the coffee shop where people come and experience our family's legacy. So that's how we landed and Peixoto the coffee as it is today.
Created a vertical business model where you're controlling the entire process. Do you fly the coffee in or do you put it on a boat or how do you get it here?
We put it on a boat. It's really heavy. So coffee, everything about coffees requires Herculean efforts, you know, to get it from the farm to here. So initially we, you know, just picked a number and brought 100 bags of coffee. And now we actually freight 3 containers. We hope to go to 4
cool.
of coffee. And that's a whole lot of coffee.
Do you do that all at once in the fall after or late summer after you harvest?
Yes. So coffee is annual for us. Some countries like Colombia, they can actually harvest throughout the year. But for Brazil, because of our climate and our cycles, harvest is annual for us. And it usually goes between June and August. And that's why, that's usually when I go to Brazil.
Yeah.
So it is an annual cycle. Once we close the harvest, we choose the lots of coffee that we want to bring in. And then we prepare those coffees to be exported. They go into a container and we break the seal of the container here in Chandler at our roasting facility.
Oh, that's great. Now, do you ship it around the Cape, or do you go north and then go through the canal, or do you take it into the Gulf of Mexico? Like, where do you make landfall?
Yeah, so normally we go, we land in Long Beach, California. So the route is it leaves Santos, the port of Santos in Brazil.
Right.
And we'll go through Cartagena in Colombia. And then it goes through the canal, the Panama Canal, and then we'll land in, we'll dock in Long Beach, California.
Right.
Last year was a nightmare of a process.
What happened?
Where boats were being sent back Colombia. But again, like eventually it works. But yes, it's a very long and monumental process. Yeah,
sure. You had to send the boat back to Colombia until you got the go ahead to bring it back?
I mean, we're just little guys, right, on that boat with 3-4 containers or importers there with hundreds of containers. So we don't have much of a say.
Your voting power is not significant.
Exactly.
That's amazing. And 3 containers, land sea containers full of coffee sounds like a lot. Is that enough to sustain, your business for the whole year? I mean, is it more than you need? Do you sell some of it to other roasters? Like, how much coffee is 3 containers?
So 3 containers, each container is 320 bags of 132 pounds of coffee.
Wow.
So I don't have a calculator here in front of me, but...
They're big bags, like this is Julia.
300,000 some pounds of coffee.
Yeah. So I think it was 90,000 pounds of coffee that we imported last year. So it's more than what we consume at our coffee shop. But we do quite a bit of business wholesale as well, where we supply big and small customers out there, going from small coffee shops all the way to big corporate spaces with our family coffee. So we bring in not just for ourselves, but to support these other wholesale partners of ours as well. And this year we have Epicenter happening as well. So we'll bring in a special container for that.
Awesome. And it's such a interesting industry. When people use the phrase fair trade coffee, are they talking about a system that kind of mimics what you're doing instead of sending a producer's, beans through the market the way you described the commodities market? Does it bypass some of that so they get a fairer deal?
So fair trade has been around for a long time, and it's certainly a step in the right direction. The problem with fair trade is that it doesn't truly reach smallholder farmers. It's usually cooperatives and large cooperatives that get, fair trade certified, and the farmers still trade with that cooperative at a price that is, presumably higher than what they would get in the commodities market, but not high enough, in my view. It's still not, it's usually a premium over what coffee is being traded. It's usually like 20 cents over of the dollar, what the market price is, but it's not commensurate to the quality of the coffee. So the way we do trading is that we assess the quality of the coffee, and then we buy based on how the coffee is drinking, on what the true value of the coffee is in our specialty market. So what that does is that it puts more money in the hands of the farmer, so the farmer can invest in better practices, in more sustainability, more transparency, better labor practices. And we've seen that over the years at our farm, where my family was able to invest in a mechanical depulper for coffee that consumes very little water. So we're able to produce this, what we call our honey processed coffee, while you know, maintaining very sustainable practices at the farm that don't put a whole lot of toxic water back into the environment. So it's a very sustainable way of producing or processing coffee, and that delivers an exceptionally high quality coffee for us. So things like that, where we feel like we can have an impact, not only on the quality of the coffees that we bring in, but also the practices at the farm level. So we try to replicate that model, not only with the trade that we do with our farm, but also with other farmers that we buy coffees from. So one of the tenets of our business is that we'll only buy coffees where we can have a relationship with the farmer. For us, it's all about highlighting, you know, who the farmer is, what the story is, what kind of processing took place at the farm.
So when someone comes to pay Shoto coffee, it's not just if your estate beans that you're selling, you're also selling other farmers' coffee.
We do, yes. So we buy some coffees from other farmers in our region, because our goal was always to elevate the coffee trading game and put the equity in the hands of the farmers, not just for my family, but for neighboring farmers as well. But also with other countries. So we have a really good relationship with farmers in Colombia and in Costa Rica. So we try to develop those relationships where we can buy it direct and put money on the hands of the farmers themselves, not the middleman.
Talk a little bit about opening your shop at Agritopia in Gilbert. And people in Chandler, probably very familiar, who love coffee, are familiar with the Shoto coffee. Maybe in like Central Phoenix, not quite as much. Although I imagine that there are restaurants around the valley that pour your coffee. Do you know how many offhand that you distribute to?
So restaurants, I would say like wholesale partners in general, we have over 100 wholesale partners, right? But when you look at restaurants specifically, that's actually a smaller piece of our pie. We have some coffee shops on the West Valley that do a really good job representing us, but we do a lot more behind the scenes with large corporate spaces that have been supporting us and believed in us from the very beginning. So
corporate spaces, does that mean like other coffee brands? Is that in you supply to them? Is that what you mean?
We can supply to other coffee brands, and we consider those to be like coffee shops, right? So they don't roast their own, but they buy our coffee and serve our coffee in their space, either with our brand or with their own. When I talk about corporate spaces, I'm talking about big companies, like, you know, big tech companies here in the Valley that offer coffees to their employees and want to offer a better cup of coffee. So
that sounds actually much more appealing and wholesome than I was envisioning. I want to work for those companies.
I know.
Exactly. It's an awesome perk.
And when will your Agritopia location open?
So we are part of this major development where they'll have residents on top and local, what Joe Johnston describes as best of Arizona, on the lower level. So obviously we're very honored to be there and excited. They deliver our space to us sometime in the fall of this year, and then we'll start our construction and take it from there. So as of today, we are slated to open sometime in Q1 of 2022.
Cool. And is it a like a work, play, you know, multi-use concept? Will people live there? It's called Epicenter, right?
It's called Epicenter. It's in the same area as Agritopia, which is, you know, an amazing development by the Johnston family with a lot of agricultural elements. And when Joe approached us in 2017, and yes, this has been
in the works for a while.
Exactly. Yes. In the works for 4 years. So we're ready.
If someone buys a house at Epicenter, will there be perhaps a dispenser next to the sink where Peixoto coffee will come in hot?
Instead of water,
you
get fresh cold brew.
There you go. Yeah, that would be taking it up a little bit in terms of, you know, luxury living.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, it might be on to something. I'll mention it. Yeah. So that is phase one of that project will actually open in October. So keep an eye for that. A lot of great restaurants, great local businesses opening up in that area. We're very excited to partner with them.
How about a Peixoto in Central Phoenix? Any chance of that?
Well, a lot of people ask us, when are you coming to Central Phoenix? When are you coming this way? Because a lot of the people who drive to us, you know, they had this hope that we would, Leah is raising her hand. A lot of people had hopes that we would actually go in the opposite direction, right? Not further east.
Right. Oh,
than we already are.
Right. That makes sense.
But yeah. I mean, I think that would be the next step, but I don't know when, because it took us 7 years to be ready for a second location. You know, Jeff and I, my husband and I, we always talk about growth, but we talk about growth in a very organic way where we don't really have outside investors. So we only grow as much and as fast as we can keep, you know, our models in place.
Right.
So we're growing very deliberately.
In-N-Out style, In-N-Out burger at the same policy, which is why you didn't see him outside of California for 40 years. But if you could be the In-N-Out of coffee, I think that would be a great outcome. So.
Although I have a feeling they have a lot more investment than we do.
Yeah, right.
To get to where they are.
Could be. All right. There is a section or a segment here we call Our Readers Want to Know. I'm going to ask you some seemingly random questions, but I feel like they're important and people will be interested to hear your answers, Julia. Okay, first question. You can take only one Bali churrascaria with you to a desert island. Which one is it?
Well, there are not too many to choose from. I don't know if you know this.
There's like three, aren't there?
I'll take Fogo de Chão because Fogo de Chão is, you know, it's really authentic. Right. I remember being in São Paulo when I was living there and then going to Fogo de Chão on very special occasions. You know, we don't eat like that on a normal basis, but on special occasions going to Fogo de Chão. So
Brazilians don't have Rodizio style dining every meal. I hope
not. No, it's actually more of a performance, right? Showbiz kind of meal,
Where is churrascaria, am I saying it right? Churrascaria.
So we say churrascaria.
It's where the guys come by, the servers, with proteins on a spit, and they basically just carve it onto your plate and they'll do as much of it as you want, you know, as you can, you know, biologically keep in your body.
Exactly.
It is fun. I have to say it's a fun process. And the your answer was Fogo de Chão? Mm-hmm.
Fogo de Chão. Mm-hmm.
And where is that located?
So it's in Scottsdale. I want to say Scottsdale Road and, Lincoln? Crossroads.
I think it's Lincoln.
Lincoln?
That area. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
We go a lot because Matt's obsessed with meat. So
does he even eat the chicken hearts? That's the one I was like, wow, that's crazy.
That's my favorite.
Favorite. There you go.
Yes.
It is. It's farmer food, right?
It is. Yes. And in fact, like in my region of Brazil, when people want to, you know, if you come and visit my grandparents, they'll serve you what we call frango caipira, which means it's a country chicken and it's the whole chicken.
Right.
The whole chicken.
The whole
Nothing
thing.
Goes to waste. Exactly. So yes, I know it's strange for Americans to see certain body parts.
Everything's strange at first until you, you know, try it, try it a few
until
more
you
times.
Try.
Fall in love with it. Right. Which state is your, I'm looking at a map of Brazil right now. I'm kind of a geography nerd. Which state is your family farm in?
So the farm is in Minas Gerais, which is very big state, right? Yeah. So it's not on the coast of Brazil. It's more in the center, but it's considered southeast Brazil.
Near the capital, Brasilia?
No. Well, Minas Gerais, yes. There's one area of Minas Gerais that is close to the capital, Brasilia, right. But the farm is actually farther south.
Okay.
It's where Minas Gerais and São Paulo intersect.
Right.
And that's a very well-known region for coffee in Brazil. So Minas Gerais has maybe like 10 different coffee growing regions.
Yeah.
And our region is called Alta Mogiana Mineira, which means like it's higher elevation and it's rolling hills. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it sounds beautiful. Question number two for you, Julia. I hear you're quite a hiker or enjoy hiking, like going to Sedona. So you've just hiked Bell Rock. Where do you go to eat in Sedona afterwards?
Oh gosh. Sedona is a beautiful place. I love it there. And I just love the energy.
Right.
Mariposa.
Yeah. Okay.
Or happy hour.
Lisa Dahl's place.
Yes. It's gorgeous. And it has an amazing view. I mean, if I want something special, that's where I would go.
But food's great.
Yes. The food's great. Cocktails, beautiful view. I just love the little hidden gems as well. I love a latte. Sedona.
Sure. Yeah, Elote's. Yeah, mm-hmm. That is. Those two places are great. All right. You also are a fan of, I'm saying it now, Pão de Queijo. Or is it Pão de Queijo? I know because in Brazil, you speak Portuguese. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the D sounds like a J sound, right?
A J, exactly. Right. Yeah.
So it's Pão de Queijo.
So what you need to do is like plug your nose.
Right. Pão de Queijo. You don't inhale.
You say pão de queijo.
Right. You see, I say it sounds like I'm making fun. I don't want to sound that way. I think I'd rather sound like an ignorant American than one who's mocking you.
No, you did great. You did great.
It's your
first attempt. Cheese bread, and it's made with tapioca flour instead of wheat flour, so it's naturally gluten-free. And the tapioca flour interacts or chemically reacts with the cheese and becomes this gooey, wonderful thing that it's really hard to describe exactly what it is, but it's just a really nice texture.
Can you get it in the valley?
You can get frozen pão de queijo at Whole Foods or Sprouts. You know, it comes in a little bag. It's called Brazy Bites. I'm friends with the owner. She's in Portland.
That's cool.
She runs a great business. So yes, you can get frozen bags of this brand, and you put it in the oven for 20 minutes and you have the most delicious snack you'd ever ask for.
And what is that, a specialty store you can get that at locally?
Not really. Yeah. No.
Get to order it.
Yes.
Yeah. Whole Foods, Sprouts, you said. Mm-hmm. Trader Joe's has their own kind. I tried it on your recommendation, Julia, and it was pretty good.
Yeah, so that one comes baked. So you would just warm it up.
Mm-hmm.
You're also a wine drinker. What's your favorite Arizona wine?
Ooh, I love those Cabezas. The rosé is deliciously refreshing. I
also like the one that's carbonated. They have it in the can. Kind of hard to find. We're actually writing about it in the next issue of Phoenix Magazine. But yeah,
it's I'm a rosé girl, and you know, I tell Jeff, hey, can you bring me some rosé? And he's like, rosé? Who? Where am I finding rosé?
Is that you pronounce? Is that you pronounce rosé in Portuguese?
Rosé,
mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm. So yes. No, I love rosé. I love Page Spring Cellar.
Sure.
They have a great Pinot Noir. So yes, I do love some wine.
Too. All right. Lastly,
even better with Leah.
Yeah. Right. Lastly, Julia, our readers want to know, do you feel compelled to root for Tom Brady?
I do.
Don't we all?
I really do. Because yes, I mean, he married Gisele Bündchen, and both of them. I mean, they're a powerhouse of a couple.
They are a powerhouse, right.
They're beautiful to look at.
Truly, their children are going to have perfect jawlines. Perfect.
Exactly. I mean, they're everyone's dreams.
It is a nexus of United States, Brazilian power, those two, and we're all rooting for them. So, well, thank you for joining us. Julia, Leah is going to end with a segment where she finds a food trend happening nationally, and then we talk about how it might be manifesting itself here in the Valley. What do you got for us, Leah?
Yeah. So this week, a lot of publications are, you know, talking about how restaurants are incorporating tipping or not incorporating tipping as the restaurant industry rebounds. So a lot of formerly no tip restaurants are transitioning back to a tipping model and vice versa. Some people are doing service charges instead because they said that, you know, as we return from the pandemic, customers are not tipping as well as they were during the pandemic, when people felt more compassion and they're like, oh, let's help these people get through a hard time. Now they're being cheapskates again. So it's interesting. I don't personally know what I think about this issue. I'm interested more in what restaurant people have to say. And maybe, you know, for coffee, what has been your experience, Julia? Do you have customers regularly tip? Or I think sometimes people think they shouldn't tip on coffee, which I disagree with. You should definitely tip your barista.
Yeah. So, I mean, for us, the tips are such a strong component of, you know, compensation as well as the service that is, that we offer. And because we offer, obviously, during the pandemic, we had to modify our model, right, to do curbside and to, you know, prevent some of those interactions that we, that are what make our industry as specialty coffee so unique. But for us, it's all about that interaction and that experience. So it's not just pouring a great cup of coffee. It's about, you know, educating and developing a relationship, a connection with our end consumer. So our customer base is wonderful. They were highly supportive during the pandemic. And, you know, there was a time when we didn't know what was going to happen. And there was a virtual tip jar for my employees. And, you know, our community showed up so strongly for them. So I have nothing but wonderful things to say about, you know, how our customers supported and still support our employees. So for us, it's, you know, we've built a really strong culture around our familia, those who work for Peixoto Coffee, and our why we do what we do. So I think our customers feel very compelled to appreciate the model and the service. But yes, no, I didn't know that it was a trend to change, or to, you know, for those who were not accepting tips to start to accept, and vice versa.
I wasn't aware there are restaurants that refuse tips, or, you know, I can't remember. I mean, McDonald's maybe. I can't think of a place I've been to where, you know, they were like, nope, dipping not allowed.
Yeah, it's like a lot of higher end places on the coasts, it seems, you know, and they either bake it into the prices of the menu items,
or European style.
Yes. Or they charge a 20% service charge. So that way that's automatic, like an enforced tip.
Right.
You know what I mean?
When I worked in restaurants, that would be the case for large parties, and still is in a lot of places. But a compulsory tip, it's a bad look. You know, I mean, not that people don't, I do 20% almost regardless of how good or bad the service is, you know, but making people tip, you know, I could see there being a little bit of a, you know, a little bit pushback. Of a backlash on that.
Yeah. Well, and I can say that in Brazil, so tip is included as 10%, which is not enough, obviously, but it's always included. And I just feel like then the service is not the same, you know, like there's not that desire to
urgency to please.
Exactly. So, I mean, that's something that I've always appreciated here in the US, you know, it's that fact that people work really hard to give you a positive experience.
Right. Tough time for all over. So good topic, Lee. I appreciate bringing it up. And Julia, thank you for coming into our virtual.
It has been so fun. Thank you for having me.
And, you know, vaya con Dios, but that's not how you say it in Portuguese. Is it just vaya con Dios?
Vai con Deus. Yes. Okay. I mean, Brazilians are big on that. Or boa viagem.
There you go. That's right. We'll, you know, safe travels on your trip back to Brazil this summer, and bring us back some great coffee, huh?
I hope to. That's my plan.
And we'll see you all next week on Desert Digest.